there is always a way to save some of your assets. It's sort of like the house is on fire, right? We can't always save the entire structure, but we could certainly put the fire out and see what sort of remedial work we can do. So in the case of someone who receives a diagnosis that is grave and serious, and we know that they will require some sort of care in the very immediate future, if there is a spouse in the community, I don't worry as much about that person because of the exemption between spouses, right? There's always the ability to shift assets between two spouses. So certainly that sort of plan is one that is not easy, but certainly easier, right? When you get to a person who is single or widowed, it's a little more difficult because the person doesn't have a spouse who needs to hold on to those assets. So, you know, the law is sort of written with less empathy in that way, so that assets can't as easily be transferred to another family member.
Welcome to Financially Ever After Widowhood, the podcast where we empower women to take control of their financial future after the loss of a spouse. I'm your host, Stacey Francis, president and CEO of Francis Financial, an award-winning and nationally recognized financial advisory firm. With the help of incredible guests, I'm ready to guide you through this challenging transition. Today, we're going to be talking about a very difficult topic, but an important topic. What you need to do, think about, and how to protect your loved one after the diagnosis of a terminal illness or a life-limiting illness. Our guest today is Candace Delacona of Offrey Kellerman, who is a family lawyer. She describes herself as working closely with multiple generations to protect their assets and loved ones in every phase of their life, whether they're just starting off, a change in marital status, welcoming a child, or the diagnosis of an illness like we are speaking about today. Candace is a true expert in this field and talks about the misconceptions around medical divorce, how you can protect your assets and make sure the person you love gets the care they need. Make sure you stay to the end, because Candace talks about not only the two documents that you must have in place after the diagnosis of a serious medical condition, but also talks about building your team. And she includes information on some professionals you may not even know exist who are the game changers to make this process easy and as stress-free as possible. So without further ado, please help me welcome our special guest today, Candace Delacona. Candace, I'm really excited to talk to you today about a topic that no one wants to think about.
Yeah.
You love your partner. They've just been diagnosed with either a life-limiting or terminal illness, and you're now thinking about, what do I do?
Sure.
How do I protect them? How do I make sure they get the care they need? Is this financially going to devastate us? Just all of those questions. So I'm really happy that you're here to talk about a not so easy topic, but a really important topic.
Well, thanks for having me, Stacey.
Well, thank you. And yeah, I mean, the first thing that a lot of people talk about is medical divorce. We're going to get divorced. That way, the assets that we have, I can use and I can potentially pass on to our children. Can you talk a little bit more about like what that really is and really the pros and cons to actually going down that course of action?
So, you know, I am an attorney barred here in New York State, and I can tell you that in New York, it's actually fraudulent. So if you initiate a divorce proceeding for the sole purpose to avoid a creditor, you could really be running afoul of some pretty significant laws. So I think it's really important that we say that from the outset. And I think that while I understand why many people hear that this is one of the options, in my opinion, it's not a viable one for many reasons. And many states who may not have as strong a stance as New York does certainly would take a look at a divorce like that. They call them gray divorces. Many states like New Jersey require that money be set aside actually for the sixth spouse if that happens, actually to avoid that sort of fraudulent action. And thankfully, you know, I'm able to impart to our clients that there is a lot of hope and there are ways to protect assets in such a way so that what we call the well spouse, the spouse who's not sick, does not have to lose everything that they own if, you know, the worst happens to their spouse.
You know, and I think it's interesting because if you go on Google and you just put in medical divorce, Candace, you get thousands and thousands of articles.
Sure.
So there's this misinterpretation or there's this myth or just, let's say, honest misinformation out there that this is something people do.
Yes.
And that they get away with it, not realizing that, I mean, the word you said, fraudulent, anyone says the F word, for me, that's the F word. My ears perk up and say, okay, I should not be doing that.
I think the sad part of that, Stacey, is that obviously in this country, we are in a position where medical care and custodial care is not free. And whether you are aging and you're 75 or you're a younger person, unfortunately, we have to think about things like the cost of medical care. So while it obviously can be sort of put in this category of fraudulent, we understand, don't we, Stacey, why our clients are so desperate.
Concerned.
Right, and concerned, and would consider options like that. The great news is that you're right, there is a lot of misinformation. I hear it all the time from clients. I'm always so happy to be the sort of the messenger of the good news and to share with clients that it doesn't have to be that way. And that there are ways to properly and legally protect your assets in such a way that wouldn't involve, quote unquote, medical divorce. Not to mention the fact, the psychological aspect of that, right? So you marry someone, you love them, you want to take care of them at their worst while they're sick, as they're aging. The last thing I can imagine most of my clients want to do is divorce the person whom they love so much.
Yeah. And it's just a frightening time from so many perspectives of the, this is the person I love more than anything.
Sure.
What's going to happen? What is their future going to look like? What is my future going to look like?
Yeah.
So Candace, from the perspective, you talked a little bit about other options.
Sure.
For protecting your family.
Sure.
What are some of those options?
Well, I think we first have to look at the category of a family who hasn't done any of the planning and there is a pretty devastating diagnosis that has already occurred. And a family that maybe has done the planning or, pardon me, doesn't have the diagnosis and you're sort of looking at what the options are so that if something were to happen in the future, what the options are. So the first is when no planning has been done and an unexpected or devastating diagnosis has now been shared. And we call that crisis planning because you're already on the precipice of a crisis. One of the things that makes it actually easier to do crisis planning is that when someone receives a diagnosis of something, we know what the trajectory is for care oftentimes, right? So if somebody receives a diagnosis, let's say of Parkinson's, one can live a really long time with Parkinson's. So we have some time to sort of take stock and figure out what we can do. Whereas if someone is planning and it's sort of the unknown, I think we have a different approach. And most people don't think they're ever going to get sick or certainly die, right? And we talk about that all the time. But when you have crisis planning, there's plenty that you can do here in New York. If somebody receives a diagnosis and you have spouses and one spouse is sick and the other is well, in New York, we have the ability to transfer assets out of the sick spouse's name and into the well spouse's name. That is a transfer that Medicaid, they call it, an exempt transfer because it's a transfer between spouses. So you have the ability to transfer assets out of the sick spouse's name into the well spouse. And then in New York, you also have the ability as the well spouse to say, yes, I have assets in my name, but I'm going to refuse to make those assets available for the cost of my spouse's care. That's a spousal refusal. Now, it's not as easy as I'm making it sound, right? In a 3-second definition, within that sort of action step of transferring assets out of one spouse's name and into the other spouse, and you can sign a spousal refusal and you're okay. Not exactly, right? So New York, for example, takes stock of what the well spouse has and says, okay, well, we understand you're signing the spousal refusal, but we still think you have an obligation to support your sick spouse. So in signing the spousal refusal, you're allowing New York, the state, Department of Health, to sue you, to say we want you to contribute towards the cost of your spouse's care. Do they sue every person? No, they don't, right? There is an evaluation done of what assets the well spouse has to make sure that Medicaid is the entity that should be paying for that sick spouse's care. That, you know, the purpose of the law is so that if the well spouse were to spend all of their money on the sick spouse's care, the well spouse herself would probably end up on some sort of public benefits as well. So that's the public policy behind it.
And Candace, can you just talk a little bit more about the difference between Medicaid and Medicare?
Sure.
Because there's a lot of confusion too. I'll just use, you know, when I'm 65, I go on Medicare. And if I need someone to come into our home to help me dress, help me eat, to help me move around, I'll have Medicare, where unbeknownst to them, they may realize that there is a finite amount of time that that care would even be offered under Medicare. And it's, I don't even remember how many days,
but you're exactly like right, Stacey.
6 months, or I could be wrong, but it's a frightening small amount of time.
Yeah. I mean, I think the easiest way for your listeners to remember the difference between Medicaid and Medicare is this. Everybody receives care through Medicare once you turn 65. Not everybody receives aid through Medicaid. And what Medicare covers, generally speaking, right, are hospitalizations and a certain number of days in rehab that follow hospitalizations and a finite number of hours for home care services related to the rehab or the hospitalization. Medicare, the care, does not cover long-term care or custodial care or technically diseases of the aged and things that go along with that, right? So that's where Medicaid comes in as sort of what we call the payer of last resort to help cover the costs that Medicare doesn't cover.
And when I think of Medicaid, I often think of very low income, low asset persons that are using that service, that medical service. Is that the typical?
I think that there's a lot of misinformation about what Medicaid is and what it covers and who could qualify. I think the bottom line is that certainly Medicaid was created in the 1960s by an act of Congress, and it was intended to cover the healthcare costs of impoverished people. That's certainly how it started. But in the 1960s, health insurance, as you and I know, was brand new. And the cost of medical care was not a cost that could wipe us out financially. And so certainly we're using Medicaid for a purpose that perhaps it was not intended when it was initially established. But Medicaid is a federal program. It's implemented at the state and the county level. And there are requirements related to assets and income. And that's probably where people have these preconceived notions that you must be impoverished to receive Medicaid. And while it's true, you are supposed to not have a tremendous number of assets in your name, the rules have been sort of, I would say, codified in such a way that one can actually qualify for Medicaid in ways that you wouldn't anticipate by still having assets. And the way that one qualifies for Medicaid is advanced planning. And that's sort of the flip side of the coin from emergency planning or crisis planning that we sort of just touched on. So yes, Medicaid is certainly a program that was intended for impoverished people, but where we are now in society and the costs of healthcare being so high, there are some people that have no choice and they have to turn to Medicaid for the cost of their care.
Can you talk a little bit about for those people that can do, and this is what they call it, Medicaid planning, right?
Sure.
Medicaid planning. My understanding is that one of the biggest factors that Medicaid looks at is if there's been a transfer of assets within a certain number of years to try and again have that person qualify from that income and asset perspective.
So there are rules as they relate to Medicaid in order to qualify for Medicaid. What Medicaid doesn't want to see happen is that people transfer assets for the sole purpose of qualifying for Medicaid. And what Medicaid has done at a federal level is it has established a look-back period, which is sort of like a snapshot. And Medicaid says to the Medicaid applicant, okay, if you want us to pay for the cost of your care, whether in a nursing home or home care, we want to see what you've done with your assets. And at the federal level, for institutional care, which is nursing home care, Medicaid asks for a snapshot of what you've done with your assets 60 months prior to going into a long-term care facility. So for 5 years, they want to see all the money that's come in and out of your account. Have you been gifting, you know, large sums of money to your children that you had never done so before? Are you giving your house away? What are you doing with your money in order for us, the government, to pay for your care? So assets transferred during that time would be called a look back period, right? That's what Medicaid is looking at. If in the home care setting, the look back is very different state to state. So I'll just talk about New York. So right now in New York, the look back period is 30 months, but that look back period has not yet been implemented by New York. So the rule has changed in saying that there is a 30-month look back for home care Medicaid, but New York State at the current time is not imposing the look back period. There are all sorts of reasons why that is not happening right now, and I don't want to bore our listeners with the details of our great state law, but for now, there is no look back for the home care scenario. So let's talk about institutional care. When people say the look back, a lot of times they don't know what it is. So if you have to think of it as a window from start to finish, and they want to know, in that window, have you gifted away money? If you have, they take the value of the gift and they add it all up. So let's say it's $100,000. They divide that total gift by the average cost of a nursing home in the county that you reside. And then that result is the number of months that Medicaid will not pay for your care. That's the penalty period.
Okay. So just repeating back two important things. Number one, that window, and for an institutional home or care for Medicaid, they're looking at 5 years. And again, if there are any gifts or things, they're brought back in and divided by what the monthly care is in that residence, and then essentially saying, you're on the bill, you're footing the bill for this.
Correct.
And then after, let's say, that 5 month period or that 6 month period, then it kicks in. But I'm also hearing that the eligibility for Medicaid in a institution versus receiving that care in your own home, in your primary residence, can be different. And I imagine, Candace, it could even be different state to state.
It's really different state to state. So anecdotally, I'll tell you that in Florida, for example, it's really difficult to get home care covered by Medicaid. There's a long waiting list. You have to think of who the population is, right? So it's quite different state to state, and the rules can be different state to state. So, you know, when you are looking at Medicaid as a possibility or an option to pay for your long-term care, it's so important that you consult with local experts in the state in which you reside to understand the rules in that state, because the rules in New Jersey are different than in New York, Connecticut, Florida, as I've mentioned. So it's really, really important that you understand the ramifications of the rules and how they could impact you. And it will sort of guide your planning.
And back to that word planning. You brought up something that I thought was, I've never even thought about, but is so true. Based on your diagnosis, with all the medical history and research we now have a better understanding of progression and timing and what that medical need might look like. And so, as you mentioned with Parkinson's, it could be, or MS as another, where it could be that you do have a 5 year time period before you need to go on to Medicaid. And so you can do a shift of assets. But what about those people who have been diagnosed with a very serious illness that is going to essentially onset much faster?
Sure.
And them needing custodial care much more quickly? Are there any options for that person? Again, that kind of goes to that crisis planning you're
Absolutely.
Speaking about.
So what I always tell clients, regardless of whether or not they've started planning or not, is that there is always a way to save some of your assets. It's sort of like the house is on fire, right? We can't always save the entire structure, but we could certainly put the fire out and see what sort of remedial work we can do. So in the case of someone who receives a diagnosis that is grave and serious, and we know that they will require some sort of care in the very immediate future, if there is a spouse in the community, I don't worry as much about that person because of the exemption between spouses, right? There's always the ability to shift assets between two spouses. So certainly that sort of plan is one that is not easy, but certainly easier, right? When you get to a person who is single or widowed, it's a little more difficult because the person doesn't have a spouse who needs to hold on to those assets. So, you know, the law is sort of written with less empathy in that way, so that assets can't as easily be transferred to another family member. There are certain exceptions related to homes and if you have a child who resides with you and a child, even an adult child. So there are exceptions. But if we have to, we do something called promissory note planning, where we attempt to save about one half of the assets. So if all else fails, there's no spouse we can transfer assets to, there is no caretaker child exception that we can transfer a home to, there is something called promissory note planning. Not to get into the weeds of that a bit, but what I will tell you is that it's sort of the creation of a gift, and we gift X amount of dollars, let's say $100,000. We tell Medicaid about it. We're very forthcoming. We've gifted $100,000, Medicaid. And Medicaid says, aha, you gifted $100,000. We're imposing a penalty because you did it within the look back. And we say, yeah, that's true, but the $100,000 wasn't entirely a gift. Half was a gift, half was a loan. And the way that the rules are written in Medicaid is that they cannot penalize you against a loan. They can only penalize you against the gift portion. The downside is you have to pay a loan back, right? So in order to pay the loan back, you use some of the gifting money. So you're able in the end to save about 35 to 45% of the money that you're looking to save. So it is not ideal, but you don't have to lose it all.
We talk a little bit about long-term care.
Sure.
What long-term care insurance is and different options for using it. And I'll just reference a client that we started working with that have beautiful long-term care policies that have a benefit payout of 5 years, which is a magic number that we're talking about. And so what we're doing is we are doing some Medicaid planning to children very quickly and then using the long-term care policy to cover for the actual cost of care. And then at the end of 5 years, hopefully being able to then qualify for Medicaid. So that's kind of a complex strategy. But just in general, what is your opinion of long-term care insurance? Your thoughts? Because also, I have seen this to be a pretty volatile topic. I mean, people feel often very pro long-term care insurance because usually they've seen someone in their life who has greatly benefited from it. Or I also see those that say, you know, my mom was sick, long-term care didn't pay out, it's a sham.
Yeah.
And so what are your thoughts about long-term care insurance?
So honestly, if you can afford it, if you can afford long-term care insurance, it is absolutely something that is worth exploring. When you are looking at your overall financial health and your financial picture, in my opinion, some sort of long-term care insurance should be part of that picture. And I think it's really important to recognize, too, that Medicaid as a program currently works, quote unquote. And I say that with quotes around it because it's not a perfect plan and it will not last. There is no way that New York State or any other state will be able to sustain the Medicaid program for the aging population in the future forever. And I think it's really important for people who are, you know, maybe more part of my generation, the sandwich generation, that we look into and do the proper research to determine whether or not long-term care insurance is an option. I think that the greatest thing that long-term care insurance gives you is options. It can provide for the ability to afford an assisted living facility that can be quite expensive. It can provide you with the home care, hiring the person that you want and not necessarily being tied to a particular agency. It can get you into a nursing home a little quicker. The care is not necessarily better. The care should be the same, whether or not you're Medicaid or private pay, but certainly it provides you options. To your point, Stacey, as it relates to, you know, it being a sham and it not paying out, I think we all know as people in this sort of industry, in this space, that it's really hard to make a claim through long-term care insurance. You have to do it right. And the insurance companies are reticent to pay out the claims in many ways, and not necessarily for the sake of being complicated, but really for the sake they want the documentation that they want, right? So yes, it is a stressful time for people. And I think that adds to the confusion of putting in a proper claim. You know, you're dealing with a sick loved one who needs the care, and it's really hard to get the necessary documents together, but absolutely can be done. And long-term care insurance is an excellent option that people really need to look into, in my opinion.
So I'll tell you, Candace, I got long-term care insurance. I was 39.
Wow.
Which just for most people out there, most people are not getting long-term care insurance that young. A lot of people are looking at it in their late 40s, early 50s. The goal is to get it before you get sick, right?
Yes.
But I will tell you, I ended up getting long-term care insurance because I watched my mother, who by 50 was diagnosed with breast cancer, and by 63 had a second episode of breast cancer that she lost the battle with. And I saw her struggle and I saw the financial implications. My family, Michael and I, were paying for her care.
Yes.
And we had to take our home where my son, I didn't have my daughter yet, where we had to put it on the market to sell it because we were paying to the tune of like $5,000 a month for her to get the care she needed. And it was devastating for us. And Candace, the only reason we were able to keep our home is that mom died, which is like
horrible,
god awful to say. And I think about how important care is, not only for you, and I say in particular, single women, because we tend to use it more frequently, and we don't have a spouse who's necessarily there to take care of us, but from the second perspective of on our children, you know, that was really hard on me. My brother was helping too, and it was phenomenally hard on him. And we had, both of us had young kids, beginning of our careers, and the burden on family members that have to take care of and financially take care of their parents, it can be really devastating. And so I 100% agree with you. Even though long-term care insurance is expensive, if you can afford it, look into it. And the other thing that's nice about the options that there are today, there's straight long-term care insurance policies where the pool of money that you're buying or it's a daily benefit, there are many different options now. Right. And I'm not an expert. We work with outside long-term care insurance experts. But there are new types of options where someone can get a life insurance policy that if you need long-term care, you can use some of that for your long-term care. But then if you don't use it, that benefit goes to your children upon your death. And that's one of the biggest things I hear, kind of the objection of like, well, what happens if I pay all this money and I don't use it? Kind of like in car insurance, like, what happens if I pay all this money and I don't have a car accident? Well, this is another option where you can have something that definitely goes to your family.
So you said so much there, and I'm so sorry that you and Michael went through that, because your life experience with things like this really informs your action, right? And for someone like you, having gone through such a difficult thing, trying to get the proper care for your mom, and then while having that emotional difficulty simultaneously having to think about how to pay for it is really just unimaginable in some ways. So, you know, my heart goes out to people like you or anyone that has to go through that, to provide the care to a loved one and then simultaneously worry about how to properly care for them. And I think that, you know, having long-term care insurance doesn't have to be the Cadillac of plans, right? We're talking about taking the edge off of the financial burden. So I think that's another thing that people should look into. And, you know, the other reason why it's so expensive is because you use it.
They're
really pricing it because it's used. And the reason why it's used is it's very rare for people to just die one day in their sleep. There's usually some kind of illness that predates a death. And generally speaking, Medicare is not enough. And in many ways, Medicaid doesn't do a great job in a lot of states. And in some cases, New York. And so I think that it's definitely worth exploring and, you know, advocating for yourself out of an experience that you've gone through is really what you should be doing, and thinking about how I would take care of my spouse and what I would be leaving behind for my kids to deal with as well.
Yeah. And I will say that Medicaid is not always the dream that you might hope it is. One of my dear friends has been disabled now for 20 years. And we were trying to move from private pay to actually using Medicaid for some of her providers.
Sure.
And Candace, the number of people we hired who never showed up, it was just like, and for some of them, the quality of care.
Yeah.
And we tried it for about a year. I actually hired a service to help. And now we're just doing private pay. It's very hit or miss, I think, sometimes with the care you end up getting.
I mean, I think you're right. And I think that, you know, any elder care attorney will tell you that the hours that were once awarded by Medicaid are few and far between. So you have people that have significant need and Medicaid is simply not awarding the requisite number of hours to provide you with the care that you really require to protect for your safety and to make sure that you have the proper advocacy in your home in particular. So I do caution people that it is not the panacea, right? It is certainly a Band-Aid and it can help people stay in your home. But unfortunately, it's just one piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, I agree with that. I know we're coming up to the end. I'd love to talk about two other pieces of the puzzle before we finish. First of, you know, if there has been a medical diagnosis, what are the documents you need to get in place? And then secondly, if you could elaborate on what is the type of team that you should be building?
Yeah.
When that happens.
Absolutely. So, you know, without a doubt, the two documents that you need immediately once you receive a diagnosis are advanced directives. So without worrying about your will or a trust, the first thing that you need to talk to your lawyer about is a healthcare proxy, which is a document that informs your healthcare providers who your agent is, who's going to speak for you if you cannot articulate your own wishes in a healthcare setting. That healthcare document is so important. So that is number one. And number two is a power of attorney related to your finances. Power of attorney allows your spouse, your loved one, to step into your shoes and make any financial decisions on your behalf, including applying for Medicaid, even creating trusts if need be. So having those two advanced directives in place are imperative. If you don't have those documents in place and you no longer have the capacity to sign those documents, your loved ones will have to petition the court for a guardianship action. We've all seen the media lately, Britney Spears, Michael Orr from, you know, the football movie, and how devastating those guardianship proceedings can be. So having these two documents in place in which you are the person choosing your agents is so important. So those are the two documents I would recommend without hesitation.
And in addition to that, as you're building your team, who are the key people that you should be putting on that team?
So I think you bring up the word team, and that is the exact appropriate sort of title for the people that play a role when you have a long-term medical diagnosis or even a short-term devastating medical diagnosis. So first and foremost, you need to speak with someone like you, Stacey, and understand what the financial picture is. With and without that person's income, with and without that person's assets, knowing how care is going to be paid for. I think it's really important that you also speak with a lawyer like a trust and estates or elder care attorney to understand what the government will cover and what it can't cover, so that that lawyer then loops in the financial advisor and they can talk about the care. And the other person that I think is really important, especially as you get older, especially as care is needed, is a geriatric care manager to understand what your diagnosis is going to look like and how to plan for it. And having the proper care providers, whether the care can be received in home or if you know ahead of time that it's going to be care that you must receive in an institutional setting, having a geriatric care manager is like your own private social worker to help you navigate difficult discussions with family members, advocacy with doctors, and finding the proper setting for which you were to receive the care. So those three folks, I think, are a really good start.
And where are resources to find these people? I think that that's part of the challenge. I imagine one of those things would be talking to people that you know where they've, you know, experienced a similar situation.
Exactly. And, you know, believe it or not, there's such great information in support groups. I have so many clients say, I don't want to go to support groups. I don't want to talk about my deepest fear and my sadness to strangers. Well, you don't have to. You can go to those support groups because they are tremendous in terms of disseminating information and telling you who the great geriatric care managers are, what terrific home care agency provided your loved one amazing care, what elder law attorney called you back immediately, which financial advisor sat down and helped you understand, give you the financial education that you never took the time to receive. So those support groups are really not to be overlooked. I always tell clients that's a great place to start.
And with that, I would love to ask you about you, Candace, a little bit more about your practice, also how our listeners can get a hold of you.
Sure. So I am a trust and estates attorney here in New York City. My practice has a sub-concentration in elder care, which is why we're talking today, Stacey. But I also take on clients doing more general estate planning, whether it's intergenerational planning or advocacy for your elderly loved one. I sort of fancy myself as a sandwich generation attorney, not only because I am part of the sandwich generation, but I know that people like us are sort of stuck in between trying to help our adult children as well as our parents and get our own affairs in order. So that's sort of my background and what I do. And I am at Offutt Kerman here in New York City. So people can reach me by sending me an email, which I know will be in the show notes. Feel free to give me a call. I'm happy to chat with you if you have specific questions about planning that you would like to do for yourself or you know a loved one that needs some help and advocacy in the community.
Candace, I can't thank you enough. We have gone through so much. I know a lot of our listeners have probably more questions. So all of you that are listening, we have all of Candace's information in our show notes, as well as a wonderful summary of the most important points that we went over today. Thank you so much for joining us, Candace.
Oh, it was my pleasure, Stacey. Thanks for having me.
We went over so many important topics, from making sure that you're not committing fraud to ensuring that you have the assets to care for your loved one, as well as yourself in the future. If you have any questions about your financial situation, I implore you to reach out to me. My favorite part of the job that I do every day is to work with individuals, answer questions about how to make sure that you're financially on track, that you're financially ever after secure, and that you and your loved ones receive the assets, the care, and the peace of mind that you deserve. You can reach out to me at www.francisfinancial.com, or you can email me directly at Stacy, S-T-A-C-Y, at francisfinancial.com. Thank you for tuning in to Financially Ever After Widowhood. If there's a question you'd love for us to answer on the podcast, we can do that for you. All you have to do is give us a call, and the number is 347-682-5580. Let me say that again, 347-682-5580. Whether you're working with an advisor or you're maybe doing it on your own, we invite you to reach out to us at www.francisfinancial.com, or you can email me at Stacy, S-T-A-C-Y, at francisfinancial.com. Our hope is to be a resource for you to help you also find a great financial advisor, whether that be with our firm or one of our trusted colleagues. Please be sure to like, rate, and subscribe to the podcast, and join us next time on Financially Ever After Widowhood.